What time is it? Game time!
Wade with a hidden shoulder fake to the rack. Oh, my goodness. Wayne, Wade.
Caps up a three.
Bam! Jimmy Butler's big time onion.
Side jumper off the mark.
Oh, put back with right hand. Felicia right in the mug. A Miles Plumlee.
Throw it.
Oh, my.
Down, big man. Throw it down.
On the new home of the Chicago Bulls, this is Chicago Bulls Live. And now, here's Steve Cashel.
And welcome in, everyone, to Chicago Bulls Live here on WLSAM 890, our weekly program inside the world of Chicago Bulls basketball and the NBA. I'm Steve Cashel. We begin with Patrick Ewing, the Basketball Hall of Famer, longtime NBA star with the Knicks, Seattle, and Orlando. I had a chance to sit down with Pat Ewing not long ago, and he tells me what he remembers most about his days playing college ball at Georgetown.
Winning the whole thing. I was blessed to get there as a freshman. Didn't get there. Look, we lost in Memphis, and I don't even remember when we lost to them, but lost to them in the NCAA tournament, and we were able to win it my junior year. So that's my best and favorite memory, winning it.
Patrick, what did John Thompson mean to you?
Coach Thompson meant a lot. As a person that played the position as a young black man, the way that he carried himself, the way that he spoke with elegance. It gave me somebody to look up and somebody to emulate.
Absolutely. Visit Patrick Ewing. Patrick, take me to the NBA. Does one thing jump out at you as a special memory all your years playing?
Well, I had a lot of great memories in the NBA. The first one is getting drafted, coming out of Georgetown. All the years of playing and battling, have a lot of battles with this team, with that some guy named 23, who's now my boss, had some great battles with him, but, made it to the finals twice, didn't come away with the ring, only was able to play one, but, I had some fantastic memories, met some fantastic guys, and had the opportunity to compete against and with some great talent.
Patrick Ewing, what did you think of the battles you did have with Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen back in the day? I mean, how big of a rival was that for you?
It's easier to look back at it now. When you're going through it, it's tough. But, they it was a rivalry. They were a great team led by a great player. One great player. Out of the world player, and then another great player. Scottie was definitely a great player in his own right, but unfortunately, we just didn't have the opportunity to beat them. And he lets me know it every time we talk too.
What was the key? If there was a key to beating those great Bulls teams, what were you guys trying to do to get over the hump? Was there one key that maybe you didn't accomplish that you thought you could have?
Well, I'm not going to say it was a certain key. They just outplayed us when it counted. Michael was able to, elevate his game and got to score and rebound and assist on most of the guys that scored or Scottie. They had a very good team, and you have to give them the credit. I mean, they have how many championship banners I see up there?
Six.
Six, so, the only ones that have come close to that is, to the great Celtics dynasty, I guess it's them and maybe, the Lakers?
Absolutely. This is Patrick Ewing. Patrick, how was your relationship with Michael Jordan when you were playing against him?
We've always had a great relationship. He and I, when we first met each other, he had already committed to North Carolina, and I was on my visit. That was the first time meeting him. We developed a friendship on that visit. He still talked trash. He was talking trash that day, still continued to talk trash now, 30 years later? We developed a great friendship, and I'm glad that it's lasted through the times.
Absolutely. How do you feel about Michael as an owner? Did you ever think it would happen? And tell us about Michael Jordan as an owner of the Charlotte Hornets.
I think Michael's a great owner. He's the person who's been around the game. He knows the game. He's played the game. He was great at the game. So he knows a lot of the things that from both aspects now. He's learned. He knows the aspect as a player. He's learning the aspects of an owner. And I think that with both those qualities, he's going to be an outstanding or is an outstanding owner.
Does he still get on the court with you guys at all with the Charlotte Hornets, Patrick?
No, he doesn't. Every now and then he'll get out there and might try to teach the guys a thing or two. But in terms of going out there and playing, no.
Basically with Patrick Ewing. Patrick, tell me about your role with the Charlotte Hornets as an assistant coach.
My role is not only just assistant, I'm the associate head coach. Lend my hand wherever it's needed. I work with the big guys, but I'm not just a big man coach. If one of the guards need help or something, somebody to talk to, I'm always here. I'm always there for Coach Clifford. He and I have been together for many, many years. So we know each other and, what it takes to make each other work. My job on the team is just to be a good coach and help where help is needed.
Patrick, do you have a next step? Would you like to be a head coach in the NBA someday?
Oh, definitely. Why do it and not wanting to be a head coach? That is my goal right now, and it's only going to take time.
Our thanks to Patrick Ewing, the Basketball Hall of Famer. Next up here on Chicago Bulls Live, I sit down with Janine Kerpiel. She is manager of retail for the United Center and the Chicago Bulls and Chicago Blackhawks, doing such a great job with all the merchandise you see and are able to purchase while attending Bulls games. And I asked her when the bull market is open.
We're open as soon as gates open, and we're open about an hour after the game as well. And during the Bulls games, we have a wide variety of merchandise. We have player product, our biggest addition this year, I'm sure you could guess.
What's that?
Dwayne Wade. Yes.
Okay.
Butler has been selling very well as well.
How about Rondo?
He's been doing good too. Yeah, good. It's really exciting this year. We have jerseys in stock, t-shirts in stock, replica jerseys. So any price range a fan wants for a product, for a player, we can get it for them. And if we don't have the specific size or style that they're looking for, we'll make it for them.
Fantastic. And Janine, something I know growing up, I couldn't even buy a Bulls jersey or a Blackhawks jersey. It was impossible. It's so great that you have this advantage for the kids and for the Bulls fans and Blackhawks fans, I know. But let's say you want to get a number 3 Wade jersey with your own name on it. Can you do that?
You can do that too.
That's great.
And we can do it for you while you're at the game. You can order a blank jersey, purchase, getting it heat pressed on, and our heat press is right in the Bull Market in front. So if you're not in a hurry to get to your seat, you can actually watch them make it, which is even I think it's pretty cool for a young fan coming to the United Center to see their jersey that they're going to be wearing being made.
Absolutely. Janine Kerpiel is our guest, Director of Retail here at the United Center. I'm Steve Cashel, talking about all the great Bulls merchandise you can buy. And let me ask you a little bit about the new stuff here for the new 16-17 season. New season is upon us, even though we're already a third of the way through. But what's the hot seller right now, and what did you see new for this season that came in?
Well, our hot seller right now is anything and everything Dwayne Wade.
Okay.
Butler. But we did a special exclusive line with a company called Retro Brand, and those are women's and men's apparel with a Chicago-esque theme to them with the Bulls logo. And those can only be purchased here at the United Center. No other store has those items.
Well, that's neat. You mentioned New Era, and you've got all the hats. You've got a number of different manufacturers doing hats, right?
Yeah, so we do have many different manufacturers doing hats. New Era is just one of them, but we do have a special store for them. We do have most of that product that's up on the 300 level also in our store in the Bull Market. But what's great with New Era is that they have an office right in Chicago, and we're able to sit down and design everything, including the visor, the under visor, the little eyelets, the tag. And it's really nice to have that designer right in the backyard, in our backyard in Chicago, to really listen to what the fans want and make a hat.
Final question, Janine. Let's say a Bulls fan's listening right now and can't get to a Bulls game, unfortunately, this year, but they say, I want merchandise. Where's the best place to get it? Can I buy it through you guys at the United Center with the Bull Market?
Yeah, you can call 312-455-7603. Leave a message if we don't answer, and we will call you back. And we can arrange a time where you can pick it up at one of the main gates, or we can mail it to you.
That's Janine Kerpiel, manager of retail for the United Center and the Chicago Bulls and the Chicago Blackhawks. When we come back on Chicago Bulls Live, we sit down with NBA broadcaster Mike Breen. Stay with us on WLS AM 890. Welcome back, everyone, to Chicago Bulls Live here on WLS AM 890. I'm Steve Cashel. Our next guest on Chicago Bulls Live is NBA and New York Knicks broadcaster Mike Breen. Does such an outstanding job. Chuck Swirsky visiting with Mike, talking about Mike Breen growing up in New York and ultimately getting that New York Knicks play-by-play job.
Well, I grew up in Yonkers, New York, and for those who don't know the area, Yonkers is right on the border, where I grew up at least, of the Bronx. I was about 100 yards from the Bronx line and have lived in New York my whole life. And grew up in a family with six boys. And needless to say, with six boys and a dad who loved sports, sports was everything in our house growing up. So, you know, we played every kind of sport possible, from wiffle ball in the front yard to obviously basketball, kickball, football, I mean, you name it, we played it. So I always loved sports. And I played sports in high school. I was on the baseball and basketball team, but was not good enough to play on the collegiate level. So it was when I started realizing that, and I think it's always good when you know your limitations, I started thinking about broadcasting, or at least being in the sports field somehow. And there was a family friend who lived in the neighborhood who was going to college at the time at New York Tech, and his name was Tony Minicola. And Tony was really into radio, and he built his own little private radio studio in his house, and you know, all the kids from the neighborhood would hang out there, and I kind of watched him do it, and I caught the bug of what it would be like to be on radio. And between the bug of radio and my love of sports, that's when I first started thinking, you know what, maybe you could combine the two of them. And it was probably right around 15 or 16 where I started to get the idea. So when it came time for college, I wanted to pick someplace that that had a really good radio program, and Fordham University in the Bronx was the place. So that's kind of how it all started.
All right, so Mike, I'm dating myself, and I want to see if there are any parallels here, because I was one of those kids that would take a transistor radio, and I know for the millennials, they're probably saying, what's a transistor radio? But I took a transistor radio to bed with me, and then I would also grab a flashlight because the lights were out, and I would read the sporting news, or I would listen to the radio. And I'm wondering, were you one of those type of kids where you just wanted to memorize every stat, you wanted to know about every player, no matter the sport?
Sure. I mean, especially in New York, I was a crazy Met fan, so I knew the batting average of pretty much every Met. You know, you knew the starting lineup of every team in the National League. I wasn't as concerned with the American League because my Mets weren't involved. And basketball, same thing. I was a huge Knick fan as a kid. I loved Clyde and Dave DeBuscher, you know, and you always, you know, I was the type where, like, if Clyde was averaging 19.6 points per game, I wanted him to have a couple of big games so he could get to the 20. You know, so I, excuse me, I love that part of it. And like yourself, I was always studying it.
Yeah, Mike, I'm just wondering, because this was a celebration year for Vin Scully. All of us admire his work, obviously, just a wordsmith and just an incredible human being. Did your paths ever, you know, cross with Vin Scully? Have you ever had a chance just to sit down and either talk Fordham or about the business?
Unfortunately, no. I've met him once, and it was, you know, I specifically went, he was in town to do a Met game, and I specifically went to Shea Stadium, as it was called at the time, just to meet him. And unfortunately, the game went a lot longer than it was supposed to do. I was supposed to meet him after the game, and he had a flight to catch quickly. So I chatted with him for about 30 seconds. So that's my only meeting with him. But I, like yourself, Chuck, I've been, you know, in awe of his longevity and his sustained excellence and his sustained passion for what we do. I mean, you and I know that
you to do so many games. There are some nights you just don't feel right, either physically or you got stuff going on in your life. But somehow you have to manage to bring that passion and enthusiasm. And for him to do it for as long as he's had, the love affair he's had with the game of baseball, and obviously the play-by-play, is something that I don't think we'll ever see again.
Yes. You know, for many of us, Mike, at least I can speak for myself, I sit in the chair. I don't own the chair. He owns the chair with the Dodgers. And, I mean, can you see yourself working until, you know, your early 80s, mid-80s?
I don't – just the travel alone would be hard. I just hope that I come close to, again, having that enthusiasm every single night you go on the air. And obviously baseball plays twice as many games as we have to broadcast in the NBA. But I think I'll always have that love of the game. I mean, I could watch any basketball game. If it's fun, it's a competitive, and I think I'll always have that. But to be doing it as long as he can, and again, his level of excellence at this age, after all these years, is just, it's incomprehensible. And I know for sure that I'm going to be a diminished broadcaster when I even come close to that age. So yeah. I just hope I can do it as long as I can, and keep a fair level of competence while I'm doing it.
Yeah. You know, Mike, last year when I filled in for Hawk doing those baseball games with the White Sox, I did nearly 20 of them. And when I would seek advice from different broadcasters, the first thing they would say is the flight of the ball. Be careful about home runs, how deeply it's hit. And so I made a concerted effort to say, okay, you know, I'm going to lock in on that. So this year, because the Major League Baseball, the league passes, they have all the games as they do, you know, for NBA and all the teams for that matter. So Vin would do the home games for the Dodgers. And I, when there was a home run, he was awesome. Because as you know, Mike, these players are so good now bringing the ball back over the fence. You have to wait to see whether or not it's a home run call.
You really do. And, you know, depending on the situation and the wind, I mean, as fans, I probably have been to 25 Met games this summer. You know, as soon as the crack of the bat and the ball goes in the air, fans are up in the air thinking it's gone, and then it's it barely gets right to mid-center field. But no, it's a craft like anything. And
the fact that Ben was able to keep up with it, that's the thing. Normally, you know, you get in your, like all of us, if we are able to reach us, God willing, to be mid-late 80s like Vince. Well, Vin was able to stay with the game. He had not lost his fastball, which is unheard of.
Right. It's incomprehensible for him to be doing it this long and still be the best who's ever done it and not losing anything at all. It's somebody that we can all admire and look up to, and we shall never see another Vince Scully. There's no question about that.
No. So Mike, you go through, you get a break, you're navigating your way through a journey of jobs, and you get the call and the Knicks want you. How did that develop?
Well, I was working in New York City for the radio station that actually carried the Knick games on radio, and I was hired to do in the pre and the post game. And the Knicks had a radio play-by-play man named Jim Karvelas, mm-hmm. who was one of the great old-time NBA broadcasters. Just had a fabulous voice and really knew the game so well. And he was nearing the end of his career, and they didn't renew his deal. And the job became open, and they wanted to go with a younger guy. And obviously, I had told them of my interest and sent in the audition tape, et cetera. And a fellow by the name of Mike McCarthy, who was the executive producer of the MSG Network, he convinced them to hire me. And I'll never forget the call I got in my house. And it was so exciting just to get the call. And I remember I couldn't breathe. It was a dream come true. And ironically, the year before, the Nets, when they were in New Jersey, their TV job was open. Their TV play-by-play job was open. And I was up for that. And it came down between Spencer Ross, who was a terrific New York sportscaster, and myself. And I really wanted that. And I didn't get it. And it turned out to be a blessing in disguise because I was a Knick fan growing up. So the following year, the Knick radio job came open. So if I got the Nets job, that previous year, I never would have been able to take the Knick job. Mm. And then the icing on the cake for me, Chuck, and you'll understand this as well as anybody, is right after I found out, a few minutes later, the phone rang, and it was a congratulatory call from Marv Albert, who was obviously the voice of the NBA with NBC and was also the Knicks TV announcer. And when you get a call from Marv Albert to say congratulations, welcome to the team, it was one of the cooler moments of my life, that's for sure.
Wow, that's a great, great story. So when you picked up that phone, you get the Knicks job. What was that conversation like when you were able to speak to your dad?
It's funny you bring that up because he was the, you know, one of the most important people in my life and my hero growing up and all throughout my life. And his love of sports is what really started it all for all my brothers and myself. And he was so excited. And he knew how much it meant to me because, you know, when I got out of college, it was a hard field to get into. And you know this, it's not the easiest field. And I spent about 3 years working upstate New York and you know, having a hard time finding jobs and not making any money and not getting anywhere. And you second guess yourself and you question yourself and you wonder if you're doing it right. And you know, he knew that I went through my ups and downs for a number of years. So, you know, obviously as a dad, he was really proud. And it was a wonderful moment to share with him.
Well, it's one thing to go to Madison Square Garden. Love the building, of course. Everyone does. It's the Mecca. But you watch a basketball game, Mike Breen as a kid, Mike Breen as a teenager, Mike Breen taking time off from Fordham. Of course, you attended every class at Fordham, so you never, you know, were able to attend a Knicks game. but Mike, here you are, all of a sudden, you're sitting in that chair. What was that experience like, your first NBA broadcast?
Well, I was hyperventilating. I remember that because not only was it the first game, the first game we did that year was on the road, actually. It was in Atlanta. And I sat down to do the game, and sitting next to me is Walt Clyde Frazier. I mean, NBA Hall of Famer, one of the 50 greatest of all time, and one of my sports idols growing up. And I was so nervous being around Clyde. And you know, Clyde so went out of his way to make me feel comfortable. And for some reason, and you know how this works, some partners you mesh with right away, others it takes some time. Sometimes you never get that chemistry. For some reason, with Clyde, it from the first game, there was just this connection that we had. And so that calmed me down. But I remember maybe the first 20 games, Chuck, I was so nervous. I felt like I was talking 100 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like I got overly excited. You know, a basket in the first quarter, I'm like screaming and hollering like it's, you know, like it's game seven of the finals. And then you really learn, you learn to pace yourself and you calm down and you get over your nerves. But I just remember I was like saying to myself that first game, calm down, just calm down, relax. It's going to be okay. You got 82 of these to do. Just make sure you make the right call and get the score right.
So, Mike, what time frame are we looking at? What year?
The first year was 91-92.
Okay. So that is the opening window for the Chicago Bulls. They won their first championship in 1991. So you were right in the thick of the beginning of the Bulls dynasty because they did win six times in 8 years. And had Jordan, you know, been fully there, he was there only for half of one season. And then, of course, as we know, you know, Houston won back-to-back championships playing the Knicks that 1 year in the title in the finals. But give me an idea what it was like, Knicks-Bulls in the finals in the 90s, as far as the Eastern Conference, either playoffs or for an Eastern Conference finals championship.
Well, it was, you know, the Bulls were such a source of misery for the Knicks fans because the Knicks were a great team in those years and probably the second best team in the league. They just weren't good enough. And the thing I remember most in all those playoff games was how intense every single possession was. And that, you know, even though it might have been the second quarter, you know, if there was a costly turnover that led to a 3-point play, you had this idea like, oh my goodness, what a huge play that was, even though it's in the second quarter. And if a team got up by 7 or 8, you were like, oh, you can't come back from that. They're too good. And that's what I remember. And I do remember, and everybody, you know, and rightfully so, they talk about the greatness of Michael Jordan and his scoring ability. I do remember vividly what a spectacular defender he was when he put his mind to it. And, you know, you talk about Scottie Pippen, who may have been the best help defender in the history of the NBA, certainly the best help defender I've ever seen. But when Michael put his mind to making a stop, there was nobody better, nobody better. And I remember that struck me. It's like, boy, everybody talks about this guy scoring. It's incredible what he can do defensively. So those are some of the things I remember.
So, Mike, when you sit in that chair calling the national game, and you've seen different eras now in the NBA, and the comparisons, whether it's with LeBron, whether it's with Kobe, and with Jordan, do you think that we should take a step back, and I'm saying we collectively, maybe as fans, broadcasters, media, and just appreciate the fact that all these players are different individually and that we really shouldn't compare eras or players? Or do you think there's a legitimacy that, you know what, Jordan is Jordan and the rest are trying to get there?
Yeah, you know, Chuck, it's something I've always kind of railed against, and I know I sound like a grouchy old-timer, but I don't think there's any way you can compare eras. The game is just so different from when Jerry West played in the 60s and 70s to when Michael played in the 80s and 90s and where Steph Curry is playing now. You know, obviously the great players would have been great no matter what era they played in. They always would have figured out a way. But the game is so drastically different. I mean, in those 90s with those Bulls and the Knicks, it was such a physical game back then, and you could do so many things defensively to thwart even a high-potent offense. But now it's not, obviously. It's so much different. You know, I love the physical play and how every possession was so important back then, but I also love the up-and-down play of the Golden State Warriors now. So, you know, the game changes so often, and just the way it's played is so different that I think it's absolutely impossible to compare eras. I know it's fun for the fans, and I get a kick out of it too, and you make your lists, but I think it's impossible because of how the game changes so drastically over certain periods of time.
So, Mike, you have called New York Knicks basketball. You get an opportunity now a number of years ago, and it's been, how long have you been with ESPN ABC calling NBA games? How many years?
Well, with ESPN ABC, I think it's 13 years? I think I'm with them with 13 years, and I did national games with NBC for a number of years as well. But they all, adding it up, it's hard for me to remember the exact number, Chuck.
Wow. So is there a difference with Mike Breen calling Knicks games and Mike Breen calling national games? And if so, what is the difference?
You know, I think it's a great question, and I think there has to be a difference because the audience is different.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm broadcasting a Knick game for the Madison Square Garden Network, obviously the majority of people that are watching are Knick fans, and things that happen, they want to know from a Knick standpoint why it's happening. You know, so say, for example, if the Knicks are playing the Bulls and they're up 15 in the second quarter, a lot of my commentary and questions to Clyde, the analyst, will be about, okay, why are the Knicks up by 15 and what are they doing right and who's the catalyst for it? Whereas if I'm doing a Knicks-Bulls game for ESPN and the Knicks are up 15, I'm going to do 50% of my comments on what the Knicks are doing well and 50% of my comments on why the Bulls are struggling. So, you know, I think you have to, because it's a national audience and the majority of the fans on an ESPN game or fans are just watching both teams, I think you have to do in terms of the balance of your comments, whereas a Knick broadcast, maybe 75% of the comments will be about what the Knicks are doing. And I think you just have to gear it towards your audience.
Okay. Just three final questions, then we'll let you go. We appreciate you spending time with us right here on Timeout Bulls on Bulls.com. The greatest game you've ever called, and it could be a playoff game, could be a regular season game, could be outside the NBA, could be a different sport. What is the greatest game where you have physically sat in a chair as a professional and called that game?
Ooh, I think it's impossible, Chuck, and you'd understand this as well as anybody, to pick just one. It'd be very hard to find a better game that had more meaning than just last year's game seven of the finals that went down to the final possession to decide a championship. I think also the Ray Allen shot in game six of the finals when the Heat tied it up against the Spurs. It looked like San Antonio had the championship in their hands, and Allen hits the three to tie it. That was one of the great games. Knicks Bulls, the John Starks game when he dunked and the Knicks went up 3-2. And I've never heard the Garden so loud, and it looked like the Knicks may finally slay the dragon and beat the Bulls, and obviously that didn't happen. That was one of the great games. And then there's one, quite honestly, that I'll never, ever forget, and it was in the World Championships, 2002. And the United States had a disastrous run in there. They finished sixth, and the World Championships were in Indianapolis. And in the finals, it was Argentina against Yugoslavia. And in the arena that night, there were so many fans from Argentina and Yugoslavia that had traveled. And they sang, as you know, international games. They're singing and chanting the whole game. It's unbelievable how the fans are so engaged. And the two teams that went down to the final seconds, and it was so well played. And at the end of the game, both teams were crying. One was crying tears of joy. One were crying, you know, tears of despair, because the game meant so much to them from their country standpoint. And I don't think I've ever been involved in a more emotional game between two teams and the fans as well that were involved. So those are just some of them. I apologize for being so long-winded.
No.
But it's
this
hard.
Is great.
It's hard to pick one.
That's NBA and Knicks broadcaster Mike Breen. When we come back, one-on-one with John Paxson, former Bulls player and current executive vice president of basketball operations for the Chicago Bulls. Stay with us on WLS-AM 890.
Steve Dahl is here. 2-6 every weekday afternoon on WLS-AM 890. Now back to Chicago Bulls Live.
Welcome back, everyone, to Chicago Bulls Live. I'm Steve Cashel. Well, now we visit with John Paxson, former Bulls player, assistant coach, broadcaster, general manager, now the executive vice president of basketball operations for the Bulls, Chuck Swirsky, taking us back with Pax to his playing days.
Okay. How many shots do you think you took a game on an average?
Well, that's the thing. You know, my whole thing was, you know, I could have a game or two where I'd get 15, 18 shots.
Really?
But then I can go three or four games where I get four or five. It's just, you know, I wasn't, yeah. I was dependent. I was smart enough to know that I wasn't going to create my own shot. I wasn't a guy, you know, with the ball, and I was going to break you down off the dribble. So my offense a lot of times was dependent on a couple of things. It was dependent on finding open areas on the floor when double teams came. It was getting out in the open court and finding shots and rhythm that way. And, you know, and fortunately for me, I played with the greatest player in the game who drew a lot of attention.
What was your relationship like?
Well, you know, Michael and I, this is funny. Back when we were both in college, we ended up on a USA basketball team together that went over to Europe. And we played in, we played in Switzerland, Budapest, Hungary, and we played in a little town in Yugoslavia called, it was Yugoslavia at the time, called Zadar.
So how old are you at the time?
I think it was the summer of 81, or 80 or 81. Yeah, it must have been 81, 81 or 82. I can't remember.
So he's about 18, 19, just, 20, somewhere in that
range.
Yeah,
and Michael just, yeah, I think it was just after his freshman year. And we had an odd mix of players, not a lot of names people would remember at the time. I think the only other guy that played in the league was Jeff Turner, who played in Orlando. And our coach was C.M. Newton, who was the coach at Vanderbilt at the time.
Right, who had Jeff Turner.
Exactly. So, but Michael and I, we spent a week down at Vanderbilt in end of June or early July in brutal heat. And Michael and I roomed together. And we became great friends or anything, but our paths had crossed. And there was this game in this little town in Yugoslavia called Zadar that I made a shot to win the game. And I always thought somewhere along the line Michael remembered that, you know. So because I'm telling you what, Michael was always as supportive of me as a teammate as I could ever have asked or expected. And, you know, anytime anybody would would bring my name up and trade me, he'd be like, you know, no. And I do think he saw that I worked hard, play hard, I cared about the game, I approached it the right way. You know, he'd give me a hard time a lot about my, you know, I had a tendency to get a little ticked off at referees and, you know, that type of thing. But the one thing I always tried to do was, you know, I didn't try to smother him or beat, you know, I mean, you got to remember then, we used to travel commercial all the time, and, you know, you were in airports together, you sit there, you know, as a group, you know, playing cards, waiting on flights, that type of thing. It was a different culture than it is today. But I have the ultimate respect for him, just given how often I saw him. You know, everybody talks about his work ethic and that type of thing, but I think at the end of the day, what I saw with him was he had a unbelievable respect for the fan, in terms of he knew they were coming to see him.
Yes.
And he didn't want to disappoint him. You know, he'd play exhibition games.
Oh, think about your preseason schedule. I mean, you're in these playing in South Dakota or Montana or whatever.
He had, you know, I remember a lot of games during the regular season where, you know, you'd be in the locker room beforehand, and again, you're flying commercial. We might have played in Boston the night before. We had to get up. You know, rule was you had to take the first available flight out. You know, you couldn't wait to get to your room, draw the drapes, and get some sleep. But he'd be like, you know, he'd be exhausted, but he'd find a way to muster it up. But I got great respect for
how okay, so the answer game. This. How close were you when he was running the Wizards? Because there are a lot of stories floating around, and maybe you can clear it up, that he wanted you as a head coach. Were you offered the job? Did you talk in, I guess, on the outside, and did it ever get serious, or was there a point where you said, you know what, I want to talk to my family and I may want to do this, and then you decide at the last second, no, I'm not. So well, how did that evolve?
He did call me and talk to me about it, and if I thought about it, I didn't think about it for very long, because I knew I didn't want to coach.
And why not? Because, actually, if someone told me when I saw you play, and I think I told you this when you were an active player, when I was covering the Bulls, not involved with the organization, but when I was working at GN, if someone told me, I compare this to Joe Girardi, there are certain people when they were playing that you could say, that guy is going to be a coach. That person has all the attributes that you're looking for as a head coach. I was certain that you were going to be a head coach in the NBA. I'm serious.
No, well, that's, yeah, but you know what? I just, there's something, I know how I deal with things, and
are you wound too tight, or is that?
It's not about being wound too tight. I can be with this game. I can be really emotional. I know that about myself, but I just, you know, and I know a lot of coaches are like this. You know, I read something interesting, or have seen it the last couple of years, about how Urban Meyer, when he was down in Florida, how that job just completely consumed him.
And do you think that would have happened?
I always kind of felt like that would be it, and I never had the confidence that I would be able to handle that the right way, you know, and I knew I didn't want to coach, and I had one little stint. I went on Phil's staff for the 95-96 team, you know, 72-10. I couldn't do any better. So I knew during that year it just wasn't part of, you know, my makeup and my temperament. And I enjoyed doing the broadcasting all those years. That was fun.
Yeah, you're unbeaten.
You kept me around the game, and the other thing too is my boys were younger. You know, they were in their, you know, they were like in the year I was on staff, they were 9-6, and I missed everything that year. You know, it started to think about it, but everything works out for a reason, I think, and for me, this one, you know, I just knew I didn't want to coach.
The opportunity comes along to work in the front office, not only to work in the front office, but to run the Chicago Bulls. When you took that job, what did you assume about the job or think in your mind about the job? Then all of a sudden you take the job and you go, oh boy.
Yeah, well, you know what? I mean,
dealing with agents, dealing with the media, dealing with issues that happen everywhere.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, you never know until you get into it. I was just... You know, Jerry Reinsdorf came to me and asked me if I'd wanted to do it, and you know, I was flattered that he looked at me in that regard. You know, I think I asked him, you know, why, and you know, he basically said, "Hey, I've been interviewing you for a long time. You just didn't know it." You know,
that's
type of thing.
That's an exact quote. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. So, but I was at that point where it wasn't, you know, doing the broadcasting and that type of thing. It was great, but you know, it wasn't meaningful. And I think I was ready to try to dip my toe back in that competitive part of it. And again, a lot of it's situational. My kids were getting older. They were in high school at the time. So the time seemed right. And I figured if this would be my one and only chance to get an opportunity to do it.
That's Chuck Swirsky with John Paxson. Well, that's all the time we have for this edition of Chicago Bulls Live. Many thanks to our executive producer, Dave Zaslowski. For Chuck Swirsky, I'm Steve Cashel saying so long. We hope you enjoyed Chicago Bulls Live. Up next, our Bulls pregame show as the Bulls get ready to take on the Toronto Raptors. I'm Steve Cashel. This is WLS AM 890.